This is Speaking of Faith's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with David Shenk, author of The Forgetting, Alzheimer's Portrait of an Epidemic. I spoke with him on February 11th, 2004, from the studios of American Public Media in St. Paul, Minnesota. He was in a private recording studio in New York. Our conversation is featured online as part of our program, Alzheimer's, Memory, and Being. Download the MP3 of the produced show at speakingoffaith.org. Mitch, I'm hearing my voice sort of bounce off the walls there is what it sounds like.
It's Krista, not Kristin?
Yes, Krista.
Okay, great.
Nice to meet you.
You too.
So to speak. Now, I've been listening to you. Are you sipping a cup of tea or something?
How does that work?
Oh.
I was talking to my engineer.
He's turning down volume. All right. Yeah. And actually, I'm not hearing the echo anymore. Okay.
Are you in Wisconsin?
No, we're in Minnesota.
Minnesota,
yeah,
right.
It's a world away. But just, why don't we just chat while we're in a new studio and I can't see my engineer. He has to stand up above the console. But
that's good planning. good engineering there.
Well, it's a different studio than we usually do interviews in. So you've heard the program.
Yes,
is that
I have.
Right? Okay. So,
yes,
and do you have any questions of me before we start about what we're doing or?
No, I'm just kind of looking forward to
okay.
Riding the wave here.
Great. All right.
I have a little echo in my
you do.
Ears.
Okay,
I don't know if the engineer can even hear me.
Mitch, can you hear that? He has an echo. Should I work on my headphone volume? Okay, I'm going to turn down my volume here. Is that any better? Are you still hearing the echo?
Let's see. I'm testing my voice.
Okay.
Yeah, that is better.
Okay.
I don't hear much of anything now.
All right. Okay. In fact, I can turn it down. Okay. Does that tell me, just for purposes of getting levels, like what you had for breakfast today?
They always want to know what I had for breakfast.
Yeah.
I had some granola.
Okay.
I'm perpetually in search of the perfect granola. never finding it, but always searching for it.
Okay.
And I'm having some tea now.
Okay. Yeah, I've been listening to you sip your tea. All right. Mitch is giving me the thumbs up.
Excellent.
Let me tell you, a couple of things. I have an intimate experience with Alzheimer's disease, not in my family, but because when I was at Yale Divinity School, I worked as a chaplain on an Alzheimer's floor of a Masonic home and hospital, and that was an amazing experience. And I can't say that to a lot of people and know that they'll get it, but I think you will get it. It was heartbreaking and wonderful and so enriching for me.
How much time did you spend?
I did it. I kept doing it. I did it sort of 3 semesters, and I'd go away for the summer and come back. And one of the interesting things was the way in which people remembered me without remembering me. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, they did. Yeah. They did remember me, but it's not linear the way we interact normally. So I learned so much from that. And so there's part of me that thinks at some point we need to do a show on Alzheimer's itself. But I decided I wanted to call you right now because we've been working on this program on loss and some different aspects of that. And so that's what I want to talk about today and zero in on that, because something that's interesting to me is that you've taken this concept, which we used to call senility, which we now, everyone has an idea of Alzheimer's disease. And I feel like loss is really one way that you've recast an approach to it. I find that word, recurring in that theme. And so I want to really zero in on that and also your experience of how you've come to think of loss differently. And then maybe, I guess what I'm saying is maybe we'll have another interview someday about the larger question of Alzheimer's, or maybe we'll get at some of that, the spiritual dimension of it. Did you hear a program we did on depression by any chance?
Remind me who the
well, it was Andrew Solomon and Parker Palmer, and then a poet and a psychiatrist who's a Buddhist, Anita Barrows. But anyway,
I didn't hear that one.
Yeah, what we did with that is, and I can imagine we could do the same thing with Alzheimer's, is actually say, okay, we know the physiology, we know the medical dimension of it. We think about it in terms of mental health, but let's look at the spiritual experience of depression. So anyway, I'm sort of free flowing here, but let's focus
isn't that what radio is all about?
What? Free flow.
Free flowing.
Yeah. Stream of consciousness. So let's just take that word loss and the way you took that as a theme, it seemed to me, out of all your investigation of this, beginning, I think, with the title of your first chapter, which was a sentence spoken by the woman who went to see Dr. Alois Alzheimer in 1901 and who became our first known patient or diagnosis, I suppose, of Alzheimer's disease. And she had said, I have lost myself.
Yeah, yeah. There are so many lines that come out of this world and grab you, but that was probably the first one that grabbed me. It just captured the essence of I think what I was trying to get at, which was a disease that I realized very early on in my research was much bigger than just this disease, as awful as it is, as pervasive as it is, as costly as it is, as fascinating as it is to learn about the biology of this disease. It's about much bigger than all. It's a much bigger thing than Alzheimer's. It's teaching us, I think, who we are, and what we're made of. And I got an inkling of that early on with this quote, and then spent the subsequent 3 years, I think, learning a lot about myself and I think a little bit about humanity through this special prism of loss.
Hmm. Talk to me about, let's just get into that. Tell me how you started to think about what it is to be human through the lens of what is lost in the lives of people who have Alzheimer's disease.
Well, Alzheimer's, anyone sitting here talking about any disease could say it's very special and very devastating in its own way. But Alzheimer's really is a very peculiar experience in that it is so slow. The progression of the disease, the fading away of the patient, the loved one, generally takes place over 8 to 10 years. It can be shorter than that. It can be quite a bit longer than that. It can actually be stretched out to 15 or 20 years. And that is the essence of how this disease is so distinct from not just every other disease, but any other human experience. We are watching a person fade away, disassemble, be peeled away layer by layer, choose your metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
So slowly that we are seeing the component parts of that person in a way that I don't think that we do in any other aspect of human experience.
Hmm. Tell me, you really did a sort of sweeping and elegant study of not only of the biology and the physiology as well as some of the social and I think spiritual, without necessarily naming that, dimensions of this disease on the people who have it and the people who care for them. But let's, tell me some of what you learned about the physiology of Alzheimer's disease. I think you sort of demystify that a bit in the book in a way that's very helpful. What did you learn about that also has implications for how you think about loss more as a human and spiritual struggle?
Yeah. Well, that was definitely my first job,
yeah,
as I saw it, was to understand what is going on inside the brains of Alzheimer's patients and try to explain that to caregivers. It's not an intuitive disease in that you spend some time with an Alzheimer's patient and after a certain amount of time, you just feel like you understand, what's causing all this. It doesn't happen that way. You could spend years actually with someone. You could go through the entire process and still not really have a clue what is going on inside the brain of an Alzheimer's patient. You really have to look at what the brain is made of and what the disease is. And if I could just go into a little of that detail,
yeah.
Alzheimer's is made up of plaques and tangles, these two kind of aberrant, malicious protein fragments that should not be forming inside the brain, but they are inside Alzheimer's patients. And they always start in the same place in every Alzheimer's brain, in this part of the brain called the hippocampus, which is crucial to the formation of new memories. So it's not really – the biology of the disease actually doesn't have anything to do with memory. These plaques and tangles aren't memory destroyers or anything like that. They just kill cells. If they were in your liver, they would kill those cells. They just happen to start in this one place that is relevant to memory. So that's how the disease starts every time, is some difficulty forming new memories, which we kind of should call a short-term memory disorder is our easiest way of explaining that.
But what's interesting, as you write, is that biological process takes you to a pretty profound reflection on how memory forms us and then how the loss of memory is devastating. There's this wonderful quote from Nietzsche that you wrote, "We are the sum of our memories. Everything we know, everything we perceive, every movement we make is shaped by them." And then you quote Nietzsche saying, "The truth is that in the process by which the human being, in thinking, reflecting, comparing, separating, and combining, inside that, through the power of using the past for living and making history out of what has happened, does a person first become a person?"
Yeah, I could you ask for a better quote in a book
No.
on the subject? I mean, it's when you think about it, and I think so few of us actually stop and do think about this, but it's intuitive when you do. It's impossible to imagine our lives without memories. It's impossible to imagine our personalities, our souls, ourselves, anything about what we consider to be essential to ourselves is made up of a collection of our memories and experience, our experience through memories. The recent ones, the ones that we had this morning and the ones that we had 25 years ago, keeping some sort of reasonable chronology of memories in our head so that we can have a sense of our past, our distant past and our recent past and our current lives.
Right. I mean, there's something in this about how the past informs the present, which is something we know through many disciplines, but we probably don't pause to consider very often. How we're constantly being shaped by things that have happened, which we have, which we possess as memories.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's as simple as our personalities being formed by our experience. And, you know, most of our experience actually comes and goes, and we don't remember very much of it. We take a few details here and there and form these hopefully intelligent summaries of and emotional summaries of what we've been through. And those collectively add up to who we are, how we think about things, how we perceive new experience, how we react to comments, how we perceive sights and sounds and music and everything around us.
I wonder how working on this project over a number of years and then also working on the film for PBS, how this started to change the way you lived and in particular how you thought about the idea of loss in your life.
Well, I could answer that 100 different ways. But,
yeah.
I mean, first of all, it was just absolutely fascinating to learn about the brain and learn about memory and how it works and to think about the things we've just been talking about, to think about how important memories are and what the relationship is of memory or of memories to the self. Another big part of this, I mean, that's the kind of intellectual. That's the distant, you know, taking a step back, intellectual part. The actual feet on the ground part is that I spent a number of years in the world of Alzheimer's, hearing and reading just one tragic story after another and kind of soaking my own brain in those stories. And many nights just weeping openly at just the utter sadness. And the thing about Alzheimer's is it is the same disease biologically in every from person to person. But since we're basically talking about a person being unraveled, and since every person is different, it's in fact a different disease and a different story in every person. So every story is at once familiar and also just uniquely tragic. And it's not difficult to experience the distinct tragedies as you go from family to family if you spend enough time.
I'm thinking of
doing that.
This Talmudic statement that every life is a world, right? And that when a person dies, an entire world dies. That's the image that's evoking for me.
Yeah, I think that's right. And remember, with Alzheimer's, it's not just a person dying; it's a person fading away.
Yes.
And it's the caregiver and the all the family and friends having to figure out something that people aren't usually forced to figure out when the person is gone. You know, you have a heart attack and you die, the person is gone. You deal with that grief. It's awful, but you go through it. But at least it's clear the person is gone. In Alzheimer's, there's a 10-year process or sometimes longer where everyone connected to this person is actually trying to figure out if they're still here or how much of them is still here. So you don't know actually how much to grieve, how much to hold on, how much to try to connect. It's this family and set of friends is feeling their way through this mysterious process.
You make an analogy at one point in your book. You say something like, loss is always a complex and multi-layered experience, but in Alzheimer's, it's slowed down. I mean, you use this phrase, it's a split-level death. So, I mean, I think you're saying we're confronting something that we confront all the time, but in some way, seeing it in slow motion changes the experience, makes the experience more vivid. Tell me what...
I really think it does. I think that, one analogy is to a prism. You know, we go through life just seeing what we think of as an experience as white light, but it's actually, you know, all these different types of light that are I can't give a physicist explanation of it, but are, you know, compressed together. And I think that most of us experience death in that single unifying way. Someone dies, even if it's a medium length illness like cancer or something like that. It can be months or even years. You experience the decline and then the death.
Right.
With Alzheimer's, since the person's mind is fading away and it's impossible to tell how much of them is gone at any one point, you're really kind of putting death through a prism, and you're seeing all of these component parts of a person that you never expected to see. And I think, you know, it's easy to talk about this intellectually, but what that means for the caregiver, for the family and friends, is that they're just seeing this awful but just very strange collection of signals coming from this person that they've presumably spent their life getting to know and love, and trying to make sense of what that means and what is left of the person. So you're just stretching out this experience to the point where you're experiencing loss over and over and over again, and actually different pieces of loss, if we can put it that way. You're realizing without actually intellectualizing it, I think that the experience is that people are feeling loss as not just one thing, but as some kind of continuum.
And if I asked you specifically in terms of the spiritual dimension of that, however you want to define it, are there stories, particular people, faces stories that come to mind of people who grappled with that more consciously? What would that look like if people were very aware that that's of that kind of gradual loss and seeking meaning in that?
Well, I think that the first thing to say is that the meaning comes to these people whether they seek it or not. The process of just going through this sort of excruciatingly slow loss forces people It forces people to come to grips with loss in a way that they certainly never expected. And what I saw, you know, the common experience for me was that I was kind of dealing with two worlds as I was researching this book. I was spending most of my time in the world of Alzheimer's, and then I would spend the rest of my life, my social and family life, in the world outside of Alzheimer's, mm-hmm. because I don't have family experience with it, and few of my friends do. So I would kind of go back and forth, and from the people in the outside world, I would hear this question virtually every day for several years: how can you be doing this? How can you how could you stand to do this for more than, you know, a couple of weeks? It just sounds so depressing to be in this world where just all these tragedies are unfolding, and you're obviously having to really dig into the details of all these lives. And I can completely understand that assumption, but the reality is that from where I sat, it was just incredibly rich to be going through this. It was sad, yes, horribly sad, and mm-hmm. there were plenty of tears. But what I saw, I've come to realize, I can now kind of articulate this. At the time, it was just a feeling, is that I saw people being forced to rise to this occasion, having to go through experiences they never could have imagined, and experiencing the richness of life in component parts through this slow, you know, prism-like loss, through this unraveling of the onion of life. And it just turned these caregivers into just absolutely to a person. I mean, it's not like this has happened to some of the caregivers. It happens to every single one that I've come into contact with. It makes their lives richer in this paradoxical way. They come out of it with, I think, understanding things about themselves and about their loved one and about life that never in a million years would they have asked to go through that process, or would they wish it upon anyone else or want to go through it again, because it's just incredibly difficult and sad. But I think that they, when I speak before audiences of caregivers and talk about the richness of life that they've experienced through loss, they all nod their heads and know what I'm talking about, because
after the person has died, or even can they feel that in the midst of it?
Well, I think that's a great question. I think for the most part, it does occur to people. It's clearer to people after they've died. And I hear from a lot of caregivers who are still trying to come to grips with what they've experienced. Maybe their loved one died several years ago, and they still don't quite know what hit them, and they're reading my book as a part of that process of trying to make sense of it all. But I want to emphasize, they don't need my book to have experienced the richness, and I think that part does kind of wash over them. And as sad as it is to say, they are better people because of what they've gone through.
Can you put some faces and some stories to that? Who are you thinking of? Who comes into your imagination when you describe that dynamic of people whose lives became richer at the same time that they were so burdened by this disease?
I guess the first person I think of is a fellow named Morris Friedel, who...
Yeah, you mentioned him, the sociologist from California.
Well, he is my main character, if you will, in this book, because he came into this came into my life very early on in this process and taught me so much about this disease that it's it would almost be impossible for listeners to believe. I mean, not only did he teach me about what he was going through, which is a rare enough thing for someone who's actually suffering from the disease, to be able to articulate it so well. He taught me, he was a kind of a mentor in so many ways. He had studied human dignity as a professor and taught it. So he was able to bring me to writers like Viktor Frankl, who writes extensively about the meaning of loss.
Out of the Holocaust.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Morris was also actually the one who brought me to Ralph Waldo Emerson, who pointed out that Emerson had some sort of dementia, probably what we would now call Alzheimer's disease. Mm. And in any case, it's worth looking at what he went through because it's just so incredibly similar to what we now understand to be Alzheimer's disease. Can I talk a little bit more about Morris?
Yeah, please do. Yeah.
Morris is a sociologist in Southern California who taught a course on human dignity, and as he later admitted to himself and to me, he was going into all these case studies of how people are faced with all these horrible tragedies that test their dignity, and he thought that it was in a way making him immune to these possible tragedies himself, and kind of ended the sentence that he was emailing me, "Oh well," and I actually later realized that I think part of what I was doing in studying Alzheimer's disease, not having experienced it myself, was trying to make myself immune somehow
right.
from getting the disease. Why did I write the book? So that I wouldn't get the disease.
Yeah.
I understand the reality that that's absurd, but I think that that was part of what was going on for me emotionally. Mm. So Morris was actually taking care of his mother, who was in the early stages of some sort of dementia, and started experiencing some memory loss himself. And his first instinct was to attribute it to what we in the Alzheimer's world called caregiver's dementia, which is not an actual biological disease, but it's just the caregivers face such extraordinary stress in their job, their full-time, 24-hour day, 7-day-a-week, never-ending job. That depression is such a constant side effect, and stress, and everything that comes from stress, and memory loss is actually not uncommon. And he went to a doctor to have it checked out, and they actually diagnosed him with early onset Alzheimer's disease. He was in his 50s at the time, so he's got a double whammy. It's not uncommon for someone to take care of a parent, and then decades later get come into the same disease, but for Morris, it was actually happening at virtually the same time. And the special thing about Morris is that he caught the disease, I think, because he was so aware of it as a caregiver. He caught it in himself at such an early stage that he was able to just do some extraordinary, and is still able to do some extraordinary thinking about it. I'm still in touch with Morris.
All right.
And I think for better or worse, and this certainly cuts both ways, the disease, as he's experiencing it, is progressing on the slower end of the continuum.
Yeah.
So he is aware still of having the disease, which many people would argue is the greatest curse of Alzheimer's. And on the other side of it, the greatest blessing is that so many people lose that awareness of having the disease fairly early on in the disease.
All right. Are there other caregivers who come to mind for you, especially vivid stories? Aside from Morris, he was obviously on both.
Right. Well, in just completely obnoxious fashion to answer your question with a different answer, I mean, the next thing that comes to mind, and I'd be happy to get back to that, the next thing that comes to mind for me is just all the time that I spent with this one particular support group of early stage Alzheimer's patients.
Yeah, tell that story.
In my research process, I went to see some of the local experts on the disease here in New York City, and I was able to insinuate myself into an early stage support group for actual patients with the disease, which is a fairly new, very progressive, very important idea that if you get diagnosed early enough with the disease, you can still come to be aware of it enough so that you can come and talk about the frustration. There's another kind of support group which has been around longer, which is equally important, and that's for caregivers. But it's now more and more common for patients who are diagnosed in the very earliest stages to come together with each other and talk about what they're going through. And this was a group in Queens. There were specific rules that were set out at the outset about who could, who was qualified to be admitted to the group. You had to be able to acknowledge that you had the disease. You had to be able to talk about it at some level or another. And it was agreed by everyone who came into the group that this was a temporary group, that people on a person-to-person, from person-to-person, people would be leaving the group as they couldn't understand what they were going through anymore.
Right.
To fast forward to the end of this story, that was a great idea intellectually. Emotionally, it was impossible to pull off because they formed such bonds with each other that as the group was told that now so-and-so will have to leave the group, they just found it completely unacceptable and essentially rebelled. And because of that and a few other circumstances, the group ended up basically dissolving rather than cycling old people out and new people in. But I got to spend a lot of time visiting this group. I didn't come every week, but I came from time to time. And most of them did seem to remember who I was. And of course, I tried to stay in the background. They would actually pull me into the foreground quite often because they wanted to know, they wanted to have someone from the outside world explain more about what this disease was. And I had told them early on that I was also studying the race to the cure. And of course, they wanted to know what the latest latest insights were. So that was just really a very profound experience for me, very sad to get to know them and to see what they were going through. Very difficult to be in a place where I was telling them about the exciting things that were going on with the discovery of the components of Alzheimer's disease and the fight against it, and knowing that none of these breakthroughs that are happening and that will happen, I think, very soon could possibly help them because they're just already too far into the disease.
And that's a very privileged experience also because, especially at this point, you were there in the midst of them, but now are perhaps the only person who was there who can articulate what happened between them. If I ask you, focusing again on this idea of loss, what did you learn about the contours of loss, the reality of loss in that group? Are there particular moments or statements of people that come to mind?
Well, you could see people struggling with the day-to-day of life and trying to one of the members had a particular problem with aphasia with trying to find the words to articulate her thoughts, and it looked like the thoughts were actually quite clear, and she just couldn't find the words. The woman next to her actually spoke so clearly that you could spend an hour with her and not know that she had any disease. I mean, she was just the cutest, shriveled old, old Jewish grandmother, and just with all this spunk and all these opinions about political views that we're going through, one of the Clinton scandals at the time, and she was hearty in her defense of Bill Clinton, and then yet something would happen, and she wouldn't remember that she had that she had brought her lunch. She would have no notion of having had breakfast or what she usually does for lunch with this group. And you could to be jarred from a place where, you know, I'm trying to paint two different portraits here. Someone who you can really see the disease, and it's impossible to not see the disease from the outside and see what they're, the kind of loss that they're going through and that they're actually aware of. And on the other hand, to see that someone is really not completely aware of what they're going through, but from the outside doesn't even appear to have any loss going on at all. And you'd have to spend a cumulative amount of time with this person to see that that the past is not connecting to the present.
I want to ask you, through that experience and all the exposure you've had to so many people living with this disease, I've been wanting to ask this question for a long time. I spent a couple of years while I was at Divinity School as a chaplain on an Alzheimer's floor of a home and hospital for the elderly. And it was a remarkable experience. And one thing I believed, but I couldn't test this belief, was that even as people lost most of the trappings of what passed for personality and dignity, even in our culture, you know, they couldn't remember what they'd done or, you know, many of the details about ourselves that with which we introduce ourselves to the world and present ourselves to others. Mm-hmm. I did believe that there was a core of that person and how they'd live their life that was still there. I felt that I could know, you know, maybe not in every case, but generally if somebody had been a happy person or a sad person, if they'd lived a full life, if they'd aged and come to this point in their life with lots of regrets. Now, that's tricky because there's so much medication that people are taking, and I know, you know, that plays with also who they are emotionally. But how do you, and all of the experience you've had, how do you respond to that idea that there's some kind of emotional core that isn't lost?
Boy, I wish that I could say that that is obviously true.
Yeah.
In every patient, I think that it. First of all, ultimately, we could study this disease for centuries, and we could meditate on it for centuries. And there are certain things that are unknowable, and one of those things is what is actually going on from moment to moment inside the head of an Alzheimer's patient. We can know a little bit about that now, more and more. About the very early stages, because these people are now able to articulate it for us because we're detecting it so early.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're talking about people who are getting to the middle stages and later stages of the disease. And just briefly to explain the biology of that, these plaques and tangles which have started in one part of the brain have now wound their way around through this fairly predictable pathway and have ravaged huge portions of the brain, and have just the circuits are just completely going haywire and in many different ways, including the circuits that connect a rational person to any sense of chronology of time,
mm-hmm.
and control over their emotional reactions to experience.
Yes.
So you know you often see someone who has a certain personality drift into this disease, even the middle and later stages of this disease, with that same personality essentially intact.
But without a lot of the details.
That's right. I think of Ralph Waldo Emerson, who was this famously serene individual. And we know from the details of the progression of his disease that you recognize the core of Emerson, even in the very late stages of the disease, and we have some really extraordinary stories from those late stages. On the other hand, there are a million stories of people, of caregivers having many, many, too many experiences with their loved ones where they find them unrecognizable.
Okay.
People doing outrageous things, saying things which are entirely against what they understand their personality to have been, and not recognizing mm-hmm. A lot about what goes on. It's you want to be to put this in the first person. I want to be saying to caregivers, you never lose the thread of that person. They're always there, and of course that's true in many ways, but it's impossible to say that that a unshakable core of their self is there throughout the entire process of the disease, because in fact what people are made of are all these different things. And I would say, I'm just thinking about myself, if I get this disease in my later years, I'll have to say, looking ahead, that pieces of me will start to drift away as I can't connect to things which were important to me, and then as I can't recognize the ones I love, and then as I can't form the words to describe what I'm thinking, and then as I actually can't put the thoughts together in the same way. Yes, I still exist. I have a name. I'm still alive. I'm still a special person, hopefully to the people around me. But I can't deny that important pieces of me are lost. They have become disconnected.
Right, and so maybe what I'm longing for is this idea that there's this core of all of us that would, however you peel this onion, that it would always be there in the end. But really, I think what you're saying is, that if everything is lost, there's still that core. You're also talking about how the core of us is relational and is connected, and that when those connections are lost, that the core also might—we can't
glorify
that idea. Yeah.
Here's another completely different way to answer your question, which is infinitely more positive, and that is perhaps the core of who we are is connected to the community of in which we live.
Yeah.
Perhaps who we really are is how we relate to all the different people in our life, kind of put together.
The past and present, right? It's also the memories. It's also the memory trails
right.
that got us into the present. Mm-hmm.
That's right. So, and one thing that does live on undoubtedly is those external memories, the memories and the observations and the experiences of all the people around this person. If you can just kind of imagine, 10 or 12 people kind of hovering around a person in the late stages of Alzheimer's disease, the disease has gotten to the point where the plaques and tangles have moved to the back of their brain now, and it's ravaging not just the intellectual memories and the intellectual part of their brain, but actually the part of the brain that controls muscles, their muscle memories, in essence. And they're not able to sit up anymore, and they're lying down, and they're in the final stages of this disease. And who knows what's going on in their mind? But we do know that what's going on in the minds of the people all around them is these memories of who that person was and is to them and will always be to them. And I think if we think of the core of the person as a set of relationships and memories that reside in more than one brain, then we can certainly say that core exists and will continue to exist as long as that community of friends and family live.
I guess maybe I just want to name a mystery here, and I'd like your reaction to it also, and out of your experience. But I'm even talking about the very end, right, where you say where muscle memory is lost, where people are beyond verbal. But I remember sitting with people. And at that point, then touch and eye contact become so important in a way that I never had valued before, because we don't need them in the same way when we're also functioning at our normal level. And the mystery was that I could sit with someone and I could just be holding their hand or looking in their eyes, and there was a human being present there, right? I mean, they couldn't talk to me. They didn't have memories. They had no idea what was going on. They couldn't move. They couldn't control themselves or their lives. But there was this dignity intact that I could always, it was very strong. I could feel sadness. You know, I could feel their grief. I could feel sentience of some kind. And that was very humanizing, those moments. And the other thing that's so mysterious is that when everything else is lost, I felt that people had a fierce will to live, even as, right? Even, and which was so mysterious in a way, because everything was stripped away. But that seemed to me sort of a real, you know, again, a mystery.
Well, there's an engine of life that drives itself, I think.
But you see it in this disease, don't you, in a way that it's so visible the rest of the time.
Absolutely.
That's a good way to say it, yeah. Engine of life.
Well, I mean, one thought I have when you're talking about the very final stages of the disease and the connections you can have to a person and certainly the real humanity that is still there is to relate that to an experience you would have with an infant. Mm-hmm. There are some really extraordinary connections about the decline in Alzheimer's disease to childhood, to infancy and to childhood. And for some technical reasons, we probably don't want to get into the progression of the plaques and tangles and the pathways of the erasing of the brain, mm-hmm. the pathways of the forgetting are essentially the reverse order of how a brain is brought online, if you will, over the first 5 to 10 years of childhood. So that by the time you get to the end stages of Alzheimer's disease, you're dealing with someone who essentially has the capacities of an infant. This is an extremely demeaning thought for many caregivers because they hate to think of their loved ones as being children or even infants. And I apologize for putting that thought in people's head. The practical reason actually for coming to understand this kind of biological parallel is that it helps caregivers who are in the early dealing with the early stages of the disease look ahead and predict how they're going to be able to care for people who are going through future losses, who are losing abilities that they have
even
in the early stages of the disease.
That they spend their whole lives acquiring them.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
And of course, it's the reverse emotionally. It's the reverse of parenting in that it can be incredibly frustrating. Speaking as a parent myself, to see that a child at whatever phase just is unable to do something, but you are always living with that incredibly hopeful feeling and knowledge that they will acquire these things. And there is just something, there's just this amazing kind of reservoir of energy that comes from the idea that these kids are learning and are moving forward. And of course, with Alzheimer's, it's the exact opposite. No matter how hard you work to come to grips with a certain stage of the disease and the abilities that have just been lost, and to try to compensate for that and deal with it emotionally, there are going to be new problems, new abilities that are lost up ahead, and the compensations that you're coming up with now are just not going to be enough.
Yeah, and that is an incredible way to think about what is lost. But also, I just back where you started, thinking about how important touch and human, just primal human contact of warmth, touch, eye contact, how that is so powerful with an infant. And then again, in the very final stages of this disease, and that it's a very real human connection. I mean, you can't think of a more powerful, profound human connection.
Yeah, thank you for bringing it back to that, because that actually is where I start wanted to go.
Yeah.
It's the we all or many of us know the experience of just simply holding a baby or just holding a baby's hand and just feeling the connection of life, looking into the baby's eyes, even if the baby can't even focus on you, for God's sakes, just feeling the power of their presence, giving them the warmth of your tone, of your voice, stroking them, playing some gentle music, and knowing that even though they know essentially nothing, and certainly don't know who you are yet, they are obviously very human, and there is a human connection going on there from day one of a person's mm-hmm. life. So to continue the analogy, there is certainly a very human connection going on to the very last moments of the life of an Alzheimer's patient.
Now, even non-religious people will use words like miracle, that experience can feel miraculous. Is there any corollary in that extreme moment of loss and reversal in the final stages of Alzheimer's?
Well, I think that this varies depending on what the complications of the medical complications are for each patient. For someone who doesn't have a lot of other things going wrong with them, who are fairly peacefully drifting into the very final stages of the disease, where their brains are essentially unlearning how to swallow and how to breathe, and their hearts are forgetting how to beat even. If that person has not had a feeding tube inserted, I must add that detail. It can be an extremely peaceful way to die. It is an extremely peaceful way to die, and I think that if nothing else, if there's no other medical crisis going on at the time, I think that it can be profoundly spiritual, spiritual slash peaceful. Can I say it that way? Mm-hmm. There can be some real, even beautiful moments as they watch their loved one drift away. I can't speak to what it actually feels like for a family member or friend or loved one of some sort yeah. to watch that happen, but I think that it doesn't have to be a purely unpleasant experience. I think if you've come to grips with the idea that this person is going and in fact is finally getting to a place where you're not having to deal with the disease anymore. You're just saying goodbye to the person, and they're saying yeah. goodbye to you in whatever way that they can. That can be extremely meaningful and spiritual.
I guess I'm sort of clarifying my own thoughts as we're talking. When you're holding an infant and feeling that sense of miracle, you have all of life ahead of you.
Yeah.
And they have all of life ahead of them. And when you are with a person in the final stages of Alzheimer's, what is ahead of both of you is that human experience of death.
Yeah. And it obviously does not have the joy mm-hmm. of the miracle of seeing someone born and knowing that there is a world of experience that awaits them and you with them.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when my second child was born a year and a half ago, in the hospital, what I kept saying to this little boy was, you have no idea how much fun we're going to have together. And I mean, that is just that was the thought that was going through my head, having a 6-year-old, daughter and knowing what kind of fun we've had and just and yet being not quite able to predict the exact nature of the fun I'm going to have with the second child, and that was the thought that was going through my head. That was the kind of how the miracle was expressing itself in my mind. And we can't say that people losing their loved ones to Alzheimer's are going through anything like that, although I can imagine that people in caregivers in the final stages, or perhaps after the person is gone, can enter a new phase emotionally where they are truly feeling the blessings of the life that they've spent with that person.
Yeah. I wonder if you had any a particular religious perspective or interest or curiosity that played any role in how you made sense of these experiences you had with Alzheimer's.
Well,
you don't have to say yes to that question. I'm just curious.
I can try to explore it a little bit, and I have no idea what's going to come out. I was raised Jewish, and I am not a observant Jew, as they say, although I adhere to many of the family traditions, cultural yeah. traditions of Jewish life, and I think I'm still learning year by year how actually connected I am to Jewish spirituality and even the Jewish religion, even though I am rather distantly connected to many of the strict observances. I do understand it well enough to know that one of the core experiences and values of being Jewish is to dive into loss, is to not run away from it, not deny it, to understand that it's a part of life and that it needs to be fully embraced and even in a way celebrated as a part of life.
Yeah.
And I can't say exactly how much of my Jewish upbringing culturally and religiously has informed that, but I do feel that it's certainly connected to that it helped me understand more thoroughly and hopefully more quickly in as I was researching this this disease, the ideas that are connected to the understanding the meaning that comes through loss.
Wonder in these years, were there texts or ritual moments that suddenly made a different kind of sense for you or were helpful as you were looking at Alzheimer's? Anything come to mind?
Oh, boy. Well, music was very important to me as I was writing this book. I listened to countless hours of Keith Jarrett, the solo piano jazz improvisationist. Actually, he's got he's not just a soloist, but that's where I spend most of my Keith Jarrett time, is listening to his solo improvisations.
Yeah.
I don't know that I can actually make sense of how that's connected to this, but it did put me in a place as I was, particularly as I was writing the book, that a very spiritual place where I could feel the power of, I think of life, you know, of life's component parts, if I can be a little bit pretentious about it. I mean, I think that there is a connection there, that someone who is searching for the next note to play, who doesn't have a plan, who is just feeling it.
Right. It seems to come from deep inside him, from a place that is not verbalized or couldn't be verbalized.
Absolutely.
Doesn't it? Yeah.
And he's written and talked about how the best moments for him are where he's completely letting go. And when he sits down to give a solo performance, which actually he's not doing in this phase of his life, but when he did do that, the chief aim would be to let go, and in fact to forget what he had done before, and just and to let things sweep over him, and I think that there is a connection there between the idea that life is made up of all these unknowable parts that we usually don't see separated out, and this person who is letting life and the feeling of life wash over him and through his unconscious brain and through his fingers onto these keys. I also think of another favorite musician of mine, Bruce Springsteen, who I could probably blab on and on about you know what connection there is there, but instead I'll just say that it your question puts me takes me to this one sentence that this one thought that Springsteen utters, and I've had 100 people who've read the quote in the book ask me what song it's in, and the answer is it's not in a song. It's actually in a show, a bootleg, I have to admit, of a show that I have. And I think it was from a show that Springsteen was performing about 5 years ago when he was kind of heavy into his preacher phase, where he would take a portion of the show and just kind of rant like a preacher, and I'm making it sound derogatory, but it's actually just an incredibly uplifting thing to have this person just, you know, take the. I mean, one of the incredible things about Springsteen is that he doesn't run away from the power of his music. He doesn't run away from the spirituality of it, and he, although he's actually in a way mocking himself when he does this, he gets into this sometimes in his shows. He gets into this. A preacher-like rant where he is actually connecting the idea of religion and music. And the line that he uttered that really reached out and just grabbed me was, "I cannot promise you everlasting life, but I can promise you life right now." Hmm. The idea of experiencing life moment to moment. I mean, it's a cliche that, you know, that we find in many aphorisms, but it's still just an awfully important and meaningful idea that I think we should be forcing ourselves to think about from time to time, because it really can be quite profound.
I just remembered something I wrote in a diary in the years that I was working with people with Alzheimer's disease, that they are living in the eternal broken present. Which is the hard way to say what you just, to make the connection between living in the moment and this disease.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, actually, thank you for bringing around to that, because there is actually a more direct connection to Alzheimer's disease, which is that as Morris and so many other people with the disease, at least in the early stages of the disease, can articulate, there is something really quite profound about the freshness of being alive when you cannot form new memories. Hmm. Again, not something that you would wish on yourself or anyone else, but being there is a very powerful experience. And actually, according to Morris and a lot of the people that I heard from, is something that you cannot get when you have a working memory. The idea of, just boiling it down to the idea of smelling a rose and then coming back to it,
and that's it.
five or 10 minutes later, yeah. And smelling it again, and not having any memory of that, and experiencing the newness of that. If people listening can imagine, remember what it feels like to be in Paris for the first time, to taste a croissant for the first time, or whatever it is, there is something profound about that. That in a way, one of life's tragedies is that we become so habituated to these things which are very, very special the first time we experience them.
Right.
And Alzheimer's patients, for at least for a time,
they lose that ability to be mundane about
That's
great
right.
experiences. Hang on, Mitch is telling me that I think we're getting cut off. They're going to cut us off. We're having such a good time. All right.
Oh, boy.
I'm going to talk to David Schrenk. Do
okay.
You need to book him again? Are you okay?
I'm sorry. I just I had one more question. Can I ask one? Can I have 5 more minutes?
I think they're going to cut us.
Okay. They're going to cut us.
2 more minutes, he's saying.
Two
to
more
me.
Minutes. All right. Here's the question. Just make full circle. I think this music connection is also very relevant, because I know from that patients with Alzheimer's can often very much respond to music, that place that it comes from within us, and can remember the words of songs when they can't remember anything else. Tell me what you want to say in closing. We haven't gotten to.
Oh boy. Well, that is just so true. I mean, we've been searching the whole hour for the human connection and the human core of Alzheimer's disease, and for people who are in the very final stages, what's left is touch, and the tone of voice, and any kind of music that makes you feel. Preferably music that they've experienced and made them feel things in the past, but it doesn't have to be that.
Yeah.
And so we know through watching that there is a vital humanity that is still going on, and we can help learn. We can actually learn something about our own humanity and what's important to us in seeing it in that environment.
And what does that make you think of with this word loss? That particular connection.
Meaning. It makes me think that whenever you lose something, if you're able to step back from the disappointment or the extreme frustration of losing whatever it is, you will find some meaning. You will discover some truth, and that does stick with you and add to your own life.
There you go. We did it. This was so much fun. Thank you. I wasn't even watching the clock. Kate will let you know what's happening with this.
Okay.
It was great fun. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.